This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pope John Paul II is leading 1 billion Roman Catholics into the third millennium of the Christian era. My guest, Tad Schultz, has written a new biography of the Pope. It describes him as a champion of religious freedom and tolerance, but a moral absolutist who tolerates no challenge to the Church's moral teachings as they relate to contraception and abortion. Schultz has not written an authorized biography. However, he was able to speak with the Pope and to accompany him on trips around the world. Schultz is a former New York Times reporter and the author of a biography of Fidel Castro, which won an Overseas Press Club award. Less than 2 weeks ago, the Pope issued an encyclical called The Gospel of Life. He asked the world's Catholics to resist crimes which no human law can claim to legitimize, like abortion, euthanasia, the use of embryos for medical research, and capital punishment. I asked Schultz about the importance of this encyclical.
This is the 11th encyclical during his 16 and a half years of pontificate. I think it's the most interesting. It's also the most coherent in the sense of being the easiest to read. Some of the earlier ones were kind of thick and dense. I think what he does in this one, which he has not done before, he addresses himself to all the basic important issues which face, I guess, the modern world, civilization, this whole question of culture of death, which has now become, I believe, the basis of his worldwide universal message. He goes into areas not only of abortion and contraception, which of course are well known and do not break any new ground, other than to reaffirm that he will never change his mind. But he then enters into a set of new dimensions about that which is happening in the world, to wit, again, his expression, culture of death. He addresses himself to all the post-Marxist situations developing in the world today, all the uncertainties, all the tensions, civil wars. And he also does something very interesting, which I think is extremely basic. He addresses himself to the whole question of science, and specifically the question of biogenetics and genetics in general, which many people will tell you, people in the church will tell you, that the question of genetics is becoming, has become, will become very soon, as much of a crisis as the Galileo question was 300 years ago.
As you put it in your biography, the Pope is loved, but often not obeyed. Many Catholics do not follow the Pope's teachings on artificial birth control. And you say, and many people say, that is probably one of the reasons why the Catholic Church seems to be losing members. Did you talk to the Pope about that, about how many people don't follow his teachings on artificial birth control?
He takes the view, and I didn't have to ask him because, he said it so many times in public and private, semi-private, but to restate it, he takes the view, yes, he is aware, for example, that great many people in the church in Latin America and in Africa, for example, are leaving the church for the so-called Protestant sects like the Pentecostals and Assembly of God. Okay, so he is aware of all this, but it is also part of his basic concept, his basic architecture in keeping the church together, is that there is no way for him to change his stand on all of the above, because it's natural law, because it's church tradition, because it's the commandments. So therefore, faced with a choice, which of course he is, he prefers to remain with these positions, which are often regarded as conservative, reactionary, or retrograde, and all of the above. And he takes the view, I have to be true to myself and to my church, and I prefer, in effect, I'm giving a paraphrase on the quotation here, I prefer, in effect, to have a smaller but disciplined, obedient, and militant church than have to try to please everybody, which I cannot anyway. So I'm prepared to accept, in effect, the reality that there may be fewer of us, but those who will remain with us, will be better believers, deeper believers. And this is the cornerstone of this entire question that we are looking at in terms of the church.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tad Schultz, the author of a new biography of Pope John Paul II. You describe the Pope as the first Pope in modern history to be a world diplomat. I'd like to look at how politics affected his early life. Back when he was a student, the Germans had occupied Poland. How did the Nazis try to control the church during Pope John Paul's formative years?
In a whole variety of ways, ranging from sending priests and bishops to concentration camps, such as Auschwitz and others, where many, many died, to closing down seminaries, to limiting all forms of teaching by the church, making it almost impossible for people to become priests, which is why Wojtyła's the Pope's first exposure to Catholic teachings was in the secret underground seminary run in the Archdiocese of Krakow, the town in southern Poland where he lived. The Germans, the Nazis, did almost everything in their power to destroy the Polish church because they knew, I guess from reading history, that traditionally, historically, in Poland during the occupations, or rather the partitions, when Poland had disappeared in the 18th and 19th century, it was the church that was the, which was the central point for resistance against the occupiers, of whom there were three at the time, Prussians, Russians, and Austrians. That it was the church that maintained the language and the history and patriotism and the faith that all came together. So therefore, wishing as they did to incorporate much of that country into Germany and destroy whatever vestiges Polish patriotism, cultural resistance they were, it was as necessary from their viewpoint to destroy the church as, if you will, it was to destroy the Jews. And they were fairly even-handed in killing Poles of Jewish faith and members of the Roman Catholic Church.
You mentioned the secret seminary in which he studied, the archbishop. During the occupation, invited seven seminarians to stay with him and study with him at his palace until the end of the war?
That is right. And this, you know, this kind of, in a way, goes back to the very origins of Christianity, you know, of meeting in secret places and caves to develop the church, build the church, you know, going back 2,000 years. So in a way, on a miniature scale, Archbishop Sapieha of Krakow, by having his secret clandestine seminary, was, consciously or not, replaying the history of Christianity.
So early on in his religious training, Wojtyła learned that being a priest could be a very political act.
Very much so, because, for example, at the same time when he was a laborer in a chemical plant, he was about 18, 19 years old then, he was reading religious works in secrecy, because under the Nazis, to be caught even reading religious book during work or any time could be in prison or worse. So from the very, very outset, he knew that being a priest is a dangerous occupation.
Did Wojtyła ever get into trouble with the Nazis?
No, only in an indirect sense. He was hit by a German army truck and he remained unconscious for 9 hours and miraculously survived, but this obviously was not planned. I asked him, I said, I understand that most people, they're unconscious for 9 hours, ago into shock and they're dead. I said, how come, Holy Father, how come did you survive? And he said, Providence, my son, Providence. And then his secretary, who was with us at lunch, said, the same way it happened on May 13th, 1981, which was the date when he was shot by the Turkish terrorists in St. Peter's Square. And the Pope said, yes, that's the same providence that saved him from the German truck and that saved him from the Turkish bullet.
After the Germans, Wojtyla had to contend with the communists. You say that he angered the communist authorities early on in his religious career, if I may call it a career.
It was.
What did he do early on that angered the communist authorities?
Only when he became auxiliary bishop of Krakow, he began to take what you would call, in the context of the time, independent positions, which meant positions which differed publicly from the law or the practice established by the communist regime at the time. Before becoming bishop, he was, he was a teacher of ethics. He was a professor. He was a vicar at student churches in Krakow. And the communists kind of regarded him at the time as a, you know, very pleasant, very erudite, very scholarly young priest who will concentrate on being a nice scholarly priest. When he became bishop, then he took it upon himself to protest all kinds of what he believed were violations of human rights by the communist government in terms of arresting people in churches, of not allowing new churches to be built. And it was the beginning of survey. At that point, still rather low-profile campaign of assertion, he became much, much more outspoken after the very crucial event in his life, which was being named an archbishop, which opened the way to papacy in the long run.
My guest is Ted Schultz. He's written a new biography of Pope John Paul II. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ted Schultz. He's written a new biography of Pope John Paul II. You've described some of the ways in which Wojtyla was a thrust into very political situations under the Nazis and under the communists. As Pope, he has played a part in international affairs. He's traveled around the world on behalf of human rights, but at the same time, he's condemned liberation theology, and he said that priests can't hold elected or executive office. Do you find that to be a contradiction?
I do. Personally, my own sense of it would be that perhaps the Pope does not fully understand or did not fully understand what liberation theology really was all about. I think that he was led to believe that this was a Marxist or totally Marxist type of approach to church and religion. Yes, of course, in Latin America, there were or are a number of priests who, to a larger or lesser extent, had sympathies with Marxism, but I do think, and this was a problem for me in the sense of trying to understand why he did things. I don't think he truly understood, again, Latin America being the great case in point, that theology of liberation was something which was simply very well suited to the problems and the environment of Latin America. And no one, I guess, tried or managed to convince him that that in the end this would be probably a positive thing and probably keep the church stronger in Latin America than it has been after he had turned on the theology of liberation and, you know, on related activities.
As a journalist, what was your approach to discussing this seeming contradiction with the Pope? Did you frame it to him in that way, that you saw it as a contradiction?
We never quite go to the point. You see the way it happened. There were never formal interviews, as we understand interviews here. I had a number of opportunities to be with him alone or just with one person. There were conversations rather than interviews. And therefore, I felt that my needs or my interests in researching this particular project would not be served by trying to polemicize or argue a point with him, you know, for one thing, not being a theologian. I felt that I would probably learn more if I spent most of the time listening and just asking questions that would you know, hopefully help me to understand the positions, but I would not say, hey, Holy Father, you know, don't you understand that you're, you know, doing the church in by feeling this way? Because I don't think it would have led to any particularly helpful answer and would have probably damaged the relationship. And since they were so generous with their time in these very informal situations, I felt I was learning much more doing that, which does not keep easy. It does not come easily to me, just keeping my mouth shut. But I did most of the time in that context.
So what was the atmosphere like when you were in a room with the Pope? What could you talk with him about?
Oh, you know, the great moment that sticks in my mind is the time when, unexpectedly, early in the process, I was invited to have lunch in his private dining room in the papal apartments in the Vatican with only two other people, his Polish secretary, who has been with him forever and who is probably as influential a person as anyone in the Vatican. And very, very quickly, and we spoke Polish, which I do, and he is very, very partial to the Polish language. He relaxes. It's a form of, if you will, almost of rest for him. His body language changes when he shifts from Italian or Latin or what have you into Polish, and he becomes a very relaxed, very informal human being. And we just sat there chatting. You know, we arranged from Gorbachev to the diplomacy over communism and General Jaruzelski in Poland and the Middle East and his childhood and the time he was hit by the truck, by the German truck, and well, his father and his parents and Polish theater and Polish poetry. It was, you know, the kind of conversation you would have with a friend almost anywhere. And
Let me stop you here a second. Did you talk with the Pope at all about his stand on moral issues pertaining to sexuality and birth control? And let me expand on what I mean here. Did you talk to him about birth control, homosexuality, abortion, things that are not only sensitive issues for a lot of people in general, but I imagine these might be particularly complex issues to talk to the Pope about?
Yes, in the sense that, in a way, I had to make up my mind how best to use my time. Mm-hmm. And I realized very quickly, because I had read massively what he had said and written in public, I knew what his positions were, and I knew that to try to go into this beyond that which he has said endlessly would simply bring the same answer and the you know, indeed clarify very little, because sexuality, about which he has written books, held lectures, love and responsibility, love and marriage, you know, all these are books in which he endlessly, for hundreds of pages, discusses it. And since his views are so publicly stated and restated endlessly, I just felt that I wanted to go in, you know, in other directions. And again, as I said earlier, these were not interviews the way we do it here most of the time, where you sort of go down the list of questions, as you might do with the President of the United States or whomever. There it was, in every case, in the context and in the environment of a general conversation, you know, stopping at this point or that point. And I felt if I would say, Holy Father, so why are you against contraception or homosexuality? I would probably be given the same basically boilerplate answer that he's given endlessly. And I don't think I would have learned a great deal, and I would have wasted X minutes on something which I knew would be simply repeating the official texts.
I think a lot of women feel that the Pope doesn't understand what it's like to be a woman in the modern world today. Has the Pope been close to many women over the years?
Yes, in terms of personal friendships in high school, in university, in the theater, and the normal course of events. But once he became Pope, I think that disappeared very quickly. Back in Krakow as Cardinal, had endless number of friends, intellectuals, artists were women and as well as men. That clearly ceased after he became Pope.
Tell me if you think I read your book accurately. I think I walk away with the impression from your biography that you find it something of a contradiction that the Pope has opened up the church, for instance, in terms of history. The Pope has challenged the church to rethink its stand on the Inquisition, on science, to exonerate Galileo, for instance. But at the same time, he's an absolutist on moral issues, on artificial contraception, on sexuality, homosexuality. Am I interpreting your book correctly, that you see this as a fundamental contradiction within the Pope?
It is a contradiction as we see it, you and I, and presumably millions of other people.
But not in his mind.
But clearly not in his mind, and he's an extremely rational person in every way. And to him, all these are perfectly compatible positions. He does not see contradiction because, again, let's go to the latest encyclical as an example. He feels that his views on abortion, contraception, capital punishment, they all go back to to thou shalt not kill. So, you know, to us, of course, it's an intellectual contradiction, and we would say, how can a intelligent, progressive pope such as John Paul II hold that which we, when we look upon each of them one by one, see as, quote, conservative reactionary retrograde positions? And again, he is not, he obviously knows what he's saying, and to him it is not a contradiction. It's his own vision of a moral stand that he and the church should take, and it's one of those take it or leave it alone, he says to fellow Catholics.
Ted Schultz is the author of a new biography of Pope John Paul II. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.